Do you like fairy tales? Yeah, me too. I'm sitting here outside in the back of the Chicago 3 flat where we live now, and I just read a fairy tale. But I'm an adult, I think, and I know that fairy tales tell us a lot about ourselves, and they express the deeper yearnings and deeper fears of culture. Those old English, Welsh, and Irish fairy tales, like the Goblin King, or the Russian fairy tales with the witch Baba Yaga and her house that moved through the forest at night on those giant chicken legs. And in those fairy tales, they were heroes, and they listened to the wisdom of the old man at the crossroads, the old man who told them not to eat the cakes or drink the wine when they were in the underworld. And they listened. Some of the young didn't listen, but the heroes listened. They were ready. They were receptive to the wisdom. And now, here in America, this is our time of fairy tales. The Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention, their infomercials on TV, and they tell fairy tales, and in those fairy tales, they feed us virtue and heroes. But what kind of people seek virtue in politics and politicians? The people that think politics is a religion. And they see liars, spinners, wizards, who fashion dreams. Some of those wizards show up in a Jeffrey Epstein photo with a young woman, his arm around her, and then hours later go on national TV at the Democratic National Convention to lecture America about morality.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Hi, Bill Clinton. But what about the audience? What kind of person seeks virtue in a politician? Not adults, but children. And they hope someday that they'll be able to pet a unicorn and hug it and give it a name and maybe ride it through the forest. They yearn for that fairy tale, and their children, no matter how old they are, because they haven't put away childish things. There are other kinds of fairy tales, too, in Chicago. And the one some are telling now, well, they're angry with State's Attorney Kim Fox for lying to them about what she did with Jussie Smollett. They shake their fingers and they curse her, and they tell fairy tales themselves, but they don't look behind the curtain to see Kim Fox's patron, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, boss of the Chicago and Cook County Democrats. Why is this? Why won't they look behind the curtain? Why do they just express childish rage? We'll talk about it, the conventions, the political fairy tales, with my great friend Charles Lipson, the writer, political scientist, and professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. My friend Jeff Carlin is here as always. He sold his parents' vacation home. You may have seen or read about it on Facebook. He's the executive producer of the Rokon Show on WGN, the best radio producer in the business. And if we sound halfway decent, it's because of Jeff's magic. And I'm John Cass, Greek Orthodox Christian, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and member of its editorial board. But enough about us. Where are you? With the shamans shaking their rattles and telling you about dragons and fairy tales and virtue, while you worry about taking your wife for a walk downtown after a dinner on a warm evening. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Well, we're here on the Chicago way with our good friend, Charles Lipson, the political scientist, writer. You can read him all over the place in Real Clear Politics, The Spectator, and other publications, both highbrow and lowbrow, so I can listen, so I can read them and understand them. Good day, Charles.
Good morning, John and Jeff.
Before we begin, Charles, I must honor compels me to thank you publicly. I've already done so privately, but to thank you publicly so that for the benefit of our listeners, for defending me against the charge of religious bigotry thrown at me by the Jacobins in my newsroom. And I want to tell listeners, when the cancel culture comes for you and you realize that you're about to be canceled, and then you have friends of great reputation and honor themselves who stand up for you, it makes it a lot easier. And I'll never, ever forget it, Charles. I just want to thank you there.
I really appreciate your saying that, John. I was outraged at the attacks on you. I thought that they were completely unfair. They were calling you a bigot. They were calling you anti-Semitic, and they were doing so without any justification at all. They took a column that you wrote that was perfectly reasonable, saying that there were these big city prosecutors who were failing to do their job. That was encouraging a lot of the rioting and looting in cities, and that this was not simply something that individual prosecutors on their own with local funding had done, but this was part of a larger national movement. All of that was true. And it seems to me that just as in libel cases in American courts, the defense ought to be truth. And you were telling the truth, my friend.
Thanks, buddy. And if there's anybody who knows what real anti-Semitism is, I suspect it's a Jewish guy who grew up in Mississippi. But what do I know?
John, besides agreeing with your comment, what do you know? I want to say I actually experienced almost no anti-Semitism in Mississippi growing up. That's not to say that there wasn't a lot in a previous period. And when I grew up, there was the KKK,
right,
and they were really dangerous. But just like you felt like you were surrounded,
right,
by your friends, so yes, did I, and so did my family. We were part of a community, and there wasn't a local KKK chapter or something like that, but it really matters. I know exactly what you mean. It really matters, especially when a lot of people are coming at you and they don't have any justification. It really matters to see people you know, you like, and people who know the subject matter, who are not just coming after you who are not just defending you because they like you as a person, but actually know what they're talking about in that particular case, defending you. And that was how I felt growing up in the Mississippi Delta.
Well, that was very, very important to me personally. And I know Jeff liked it as well. And so did many other friends. Definitely. And you started a wave of them. But now if we might move on to the subject at hand, which is what the heck is going on our national television? I'm watching the virtue signaling from the Democratic side, and I suppose we'll see similar virtue signaling from the Republican side. How does that all fit into the American life to see these people in little boxes, not speaking to audiences, but basically selling us like figurines, like Yadro or something? It's just like the home shopping network for politics. And I wonder what you make of it.
I should say the first thing I should say about these virtual conventions is that I'm not watching them. It just seems like a total waste of time. I'll watch occasional newscasts later to see what went on, but mostly I'll just read things about it. It doesn't seem to me that if there's anything that's really new or interesting that's going to happen. What's happening is a kind of sculpted event. And so what you need to know is who do they want to put forward and so forth. Let me go to a real life event that happened that most people don't know about. When Mubarak was overthrown in Egypt and there were millions of people who were gathered in the street, hundreds of thousands at least, in the main square in Cairo, which is called Tahrir Square. The people who were behind the effort to overthrow Mubarak, I'm not favoring Mubarak, I'm just describing what happened. Mubarak was a military leader and had a kind of dictatorship in Egypt as his predecessors had, Sadat and so forth. They were all military guys. And their opponent was the Muslim Brotherhood, which was an extreme Muslim group. They had been marginalized until President Obama was inaugurated and on his first international tour. His first stop was in Egypt, and he demanded that the Muslim Brotherhood be part of the audience, and it legitimized them. And when they went to overthrow Mubarak, there were this big popular movement. And the only people the Muslim Brotherhood allowed to be on television from Tahrir Square were Western liberals who spoke English, or for the French TV spoke French and so forth, but they were liberals and they didn't actually represent the movement that was taking over. It was a sculpted, restricted political event for people who were credulous out there, like CNN or whatever. And they were presenting this as what was really happening. I think that that's kind of what the Democratic National Convention has to be looked at. You don't know what kind of people will really be in charge when Joe Biden takes office, should he win. You don't know if it's going to be the sort of center of gravity that now exists in the Democratic Party, which is very much to the left, or it's going to be further left than that, or it's going to be what Bill Clinton and others say it is. You don't know if who are the people in Tahrir Square, and that's what John Kasich is telling you. He's telling you, don't pay attention to your lying eyes.
as he stands on the crossroads in Ohio on a country road. And I kept thinking as I'm watching him standing there, Kasich, a man without a country or a party, I'm sorry, man without a party. I'm thinking, I wish he had a guitar and he was waiting for Satan to teach him how to play this here guitar and maybe make a deal, because it was, there was a rather Twilight Zone aspect to it, but the whole thing is that way. And I would assume the Republican convention will be, you know, cast similarly.
Sure.
Where it's just an infomercial, they're selling Yadro. I think the difference might be no credible person could pretend that Donald Trump is a man of virtue, but they'll offer pragmatic, you know, Donald Trump the pragmatist.
What they'll say is Donald Trump is a man of his word. The promising, and I think most people think that for better or for worse. They don't think Mexico was going to pay for the wall, but they did think he was going to build a wall.
Right.
And I would actually say that among politicians who've made electoral promises before the election, he's done more to fulfill the promises that he's made than any politician I know. I mean, the
UAE.
You can dislike those promises.
Right.
I mean, that's perfectly fine. But I don't think he falls prey to what so many politicians do, which is that he didn't really do what he said he was going to do. I think he did do what he said he was going to do.
And that's what I think threatens the establishment. That's what that's why they hated him so much. And I believe also that the media coverage of this man since the beginning, and you can look at it, just look at the sort of puppy, the wiggling puppies around Michelle Obama's feet from the media after her performance at the Democratic National Convention. It tells you a lot about the media's attitude, not toward the politicians themselves, but to the voters. To, you know, I think in the main, not all, but in the main, mm-hmm. the Beltway media particularly, loathes the American people who voted for Trump. And I think they believe in Hillary's basket of deplorables thing. I find no way around it after watching the coverage and after reading Charles Lipson, and I'm referring to the August 18th story by our guest Charles Lipson in Real Clear Politics, one of my favorite and my first favorite go-to site because it offers political views of the left and the right, kind of like what newspapers used to do. It begins, the story that Mr. Lipson, our guest, writes, is headlined, "Will the Dam Break After Kleinsmith's Plea?" And it begins, news reports have downplayed the significance of former FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith's guilty plea, acknowledging that he altered an official document in the government's Trump-Russia collusion probe. There has been some coverage mainly because it is so rare to see FBI agents charged with a felony, and because it is the first tangible result of U.S. Attorney John Durham's sprawling investigation of the investigators. But mainstream news outlets have minimized its importance. It is only one count, they say, and it deals with a relatively minor crime by a mid-level figure. Charles Lipson, you've been writing about this for quite some time. Written about what happened in the Trump-Russia collusion probe as a put-up job. You've written about the media. I call it a Chicago way takedown. But you say that's spin and it's wrong. This plea is like finding water seeping from the base of a dam. The problem is not one muddy puddle, says Charles Lipson, who lived through the 1991 flood. Richard M. Daley, But the problem is that it foreshadows the dam's failure releasing a torrent. I have to say, Charles, that is just excellent. And what does it say about media ignoring, or relatively ignoring, this Russia collusion deconstruction by Mr. Durham?
Well, thanks for that, John. It seems to me that on almost all these stories, we come back to the same two points. One is something bad happened out in the real world. And the second is the media is so busy spinning it that you end up having to critique the media and not just go straight to the story. But I think when we look at the whole gross inflation and ultimately a kind of hoax on the Russia collusion narrative that lasted the entirety, really, of the Trump presidency, the media was an open collaborator in it. And now we've turned to the investigation of the investigators. What did Comey at the FBI, what did Brennan at the CIA and a number of other people, Clapper and so forth, what did they do? And has the media reported it? And the answer is they didn't report it. They're not reporting it now. And what I'm saying, what did Klein Smith do? Why was there even spying on Carter Page? Carter Page was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He spent some time in Russia because he was trying to make oil deals. And what the people at the FBI wanted to do was to spy on him as a, quote, foreign agent. Why did they want to do that? Well, because he was involved with the Trump campaign and new people in Trump world. And if you spied on him, if you got a warrant to spy on him as a foreign, as a Russian agent, you could not only spy on him, but you could spy on the people he talked with. And sometimes you could spy on the people they talked with. So you had this window into this whole world, which we know Obama himself and his White House wanted. We know that from texting between Peter Strzok and his lover Lisa Page.
It was done by the book, Charles. That's what Susan Rice tells us. Right. By the book.
Exactly. And we know they wanted to do all of that. The problem was he wasn't a Russian spy. So they asked the FBI, before they got the warrant, before they put in for the first warrant, they got it an initial warrant, and they did it with three renewals. They asked the CIA, hey, is this guy working with you? And the CIA wrote back an email that says, yes, he is working with us.
And in other words, yes, he is spying on the Russians on behalf of the United States.
Right. That's correct. And Klein Smith inserted the word not into that email. He is not our agent. And that was presented only in the fourth of these warrant applications. But that warrant application was submitted by Robert Mueller, Andrew Weissman, and that group. So it directly implicates them. And what's particularly important about what Klein Smith is doing is that he said that he actually circulated the truthful memo to a lot of people as well. So they knew. It wasn't just that he was lying. It's that they knew he was lying, and they still presented this. So in a way, it's like the evidence that we had about the Steele dossier, which was much more important. The Steele dossier was not only false, but then people knew it was false, and they knew that the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton had directly paid for it, and they hid that from the FISA court. You're not allowed to do that before the FISA court. And then when you learn of it, if you made an initial mistake, you're required to tell them right away. And we know they didn't do any of that. In order for Kleinsmith to make this plea, he could have been charged with much more serious crimes. The only reason that he would be allowed to make this plea is if he is cooperating. And the key, one of the key questions in the whole Durham probe is how many people are really going to be cooperating. And what I say here is that you can't take Kleinsmith's word. He is going to already be pleading guilty to, in effect, lying, right? I mean, to changing a document. But he can point out, he was right in the middle of a lot of this. He wasn't a senior figure, he was a mid-level figure. But he can tell you who was involved. He can point you through the FBI's internal communication system, which should have documents on who else received all of this. Yes. And I think that makes it all a big deal. Why? Because all of this was part of a systematic effort to take down the President of the United States using false information that they knew was false and organizing it in a systematic way. And those people in the FBI and some people in the State Department and some people in the intelligence community worked closely with Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, all the Democrats on the Hill, and they worked extremely closely with the Washington Post, New York Times, and others, especially the Washington Post. And now that we know that all that stuff was a hoax, the media is not only not backtracking, they're not doing what Woodward and Bernstein did in Watergate, which is investigating what really happened. And they're not doing it because it's their ox and their friend's ox that's being gored.
But what that does is illustrate, I mean, your mention of the Washington Post and the New York Times, both newspapers received Pulitzer Prizes, which I think are now just basically toilet paper prizes after the elevation of identity politics and that ridiculous 1619 project as a Pulitzer Prize worthy subject. But they have had that Pulitzer Prize in their hands. And now I wonder, like the Pulitzer Prize of the past, you know, the one from Russia.
Walter Duranty, who covered up for Stalin, right, and who was a reporter for the Times. And he got a Pulitzer for that, and they've never returned it.
But he did look good in drag in that movie I recommended. It was about the Welsh journalist who was actually found out about the Ukrainian famine that Duranty was trying to cover up. And Duranty as well tried to cancel this guy out. Mr. Jones is the movie.
Yeah.
Canceled him out without Twitter in those days. But the larger thing now is what, when the American people cannot look to the New York Times or the Washington Post for honest coverage or the media for honest coverage, and we come to a place perhaps in the next few months where we have questions about the, you know, accuracy of the vote, right? Because we're, I guess, going to do it the Chicago way and have the nice man mail in our ballots for us. Where are we as a republic?
Well, the way I see it is that both sides, and it goes beyond maybe both sides, I think a wide range in the public now really has no confidence in the legitimacy of the government. And I want to contrast it with what happened when Bush and Gore fought in 2000 for the nomination. And it's not really clear that if we had a completely sort of God's eye view of what the vote is, it's not clear who won, because we all know it was really close in Florida and there were the hanging chads and so forth. But when the Supreme Court ultimately decided how that vote counting should be done, the Gore conceded and there weren't people rioting in the streets over the outcome. And as I say, you could have made an argument that George W. Bush, not that he was a bad president, a lot of people said that, but that he was not legitimately the president. That was the problem when Trump, for example, falsely accused Barack Obama of not being born in the United States. He was saying, this man is not the legitimate president of the United States. That's why it was so invidious.
Yes.
And what the whole Russia hoax thing that hung over the Trump presidency was saying is that he's not the legitimate president of the United States. He was elected because a foreign enemy put him in office. And when Mueller came in to investigate, and I initially supported that.
So did I.
And I thought, well, he should be able to resolve at least that question very quickly, that that the vote count, that not many votes were changed, and more importantly, that the Trump campaign didn't collude with Russia to win the election. And we now know that they actually knew that the day they walked in the door. There was already all the evidence they needed. Maybe they needed to spend a few months interviewing some other people and nailing that down. But they owed the American people a prompt answer, which they had in hand fairly soon, but they didn't do that. They kept investigating and investigating and investigating, and they never told the American public the answer to the question for which they'd been appointed. And what they continued to do was basically build up a record using grand jury subpoenas to do the work of the Adam Schiff committee and the Jerry Nadler committee, and then they were trying to nail Trump on a false statement charge of obstructing justice, because they were continuing this investigation, and if he wasn't going to cooperate with them, wasn't he obstructing justice? So it seemed to me that they went off the rails, and again the media helped them. If you have a conflict, we don't have a vote counting system now that will ensure that if it's a close election, that the true vote, the true underlying God's eye vote of what happened, is the vote that will be recorded in battleground states. And if that is the case and the race is close, people will say, well, you say Biden won, but I think Trump won, or you say Trump won, but I think Biden won. And in the current environment, it's so much different from Bush v. Gore. There are going to be people who say the current winner is not legitimate, and it won't matter whether Biden or Trump won. The other side will say this is not legitimate. Now, if it's Trump who wins, it's going to be fueled also by mainstream media. But the point is, it's a very dangerous situation in a democracy to have this kind of illegitimacy hanging over a duly elected president. That is, the question will be, was he truly duly elected?
United, we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America. We'll choose hope over fear, Facts over fiction, fairness over privilege. I'm a proud Democrat, and I'll be proud to carry the banner of our party into the general election. So it's with great honor and humility I accept this nomination for President of the United States of America.
The message from the Democratic National Convention, as far as I'm concerned, is the reduction of America into two groups. They offer two groups, the oppressed and the oppressors. You can only be one or the other in their mind. And that, in that way, that formula leads to conflict and political violence. As a son of a man and of a family that lived through the Greek Civil War, I can tell you that it starts, what I hear, it starts just like it did in Chicago with the Ronald McDonald House people. Who were victims. It starts over politics, and it devolves quickly into revenge. And then it's you know, the horse is out of the barn then. And I find that this shrieking about the post office and all this stuff, the missing post boxes, all this is by design, by people of the Democratic Party, people that I want to respect, like the Speaker of the House, the Senate Minority Leader, and others who are fomenting the uncertainty and fear in a way that could have disastrous result. And I don't think, do they care? I mean, that's not a fairy tale. That's really happening.
That's exactly what's happening.
It, I mean, to be fair, John, too, the man in the White House, the president, is doing the same thing at every rally and every place he goes. So I
he's reacting to it. I agree. I agree that he is. He's fomenting. He's he handled it badly. He talked about denying the post office funds, and they jumped on and exacerbate. But this is not clearly the man is not articulate. Okay. We understand that he's not a silky, and he speaks like a carnival barker. The issue, no one's saying that Mr. Trump is a man of virtue. What I'm saying is he's a man of action. But the fomenting of the, it's like Stacey Adams, Jeff. She lost. She's not the governor. She lost, but she lost because she was oppressed, because the voters oppressed. And I know, and you know, and Charles Lipson knows that from Chicago, that if you did not call the voter rolls, and if the Board of Election did not go and see who's dead and who's not, they would not mail the ballots to the dead, because you know what happens when the dead get ballots, Jeff? They vote.
They vote. No, I know.
Right?
I know. I'm just depend that he is just as equally to blame for any fomenting of anybody being upset and getting crazy or agitated, but at a different extreme. That's only my point, is that I feel both of these groups are just equally dangerous to our republic and are dangerous to the democracy that we've built over the
last. I disagree respectfully, my friend. Okay. I'm not saying that he's not a fomenter of anxiety, because he does that, because he reflects the anxiety of 60 million plus people. What I'm saying is that when you set up a system, a culture that says, for example, the 1619 project that they have adopted and teach in the public schools, which say white people are evil, the United States is evil, its roots are evil, its seed is evil, and don't see the beauty of this country, what happens is you see only oppressed and oppressors, that you set up violence in down the road. I would think that any reasonable historian would come to this view in the future, after the Chinese eat our lunch and take us over, if there is history.
Well, I think we're going to, I think, by the way, on the Chinese, who are, I mean, they have a clear preference here in the election, but and they will try to interfere, and the Russians will try to interfere, and all of that will contribute to these problems. I was trying to draw attention to the sort of broad sense in the public that things are spinning out of control and that the people in charge are neither very competent nor, in some cases, do they feel like they're legitimately in office. This is a very bad situation in a democracy. It's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse for two reasons. One is that the closer we get to the election, the more incentive there will be to demonize the other party, and there'll be plenty of ammunition to do that. The Republicans, with the exception of John Kasich and a few kind of never Trump Republicans, are incredibly enthusiastic about voting for Trump. There's not the same enthusiasm about voting for Biden, but I think people have misinterpreted the enthusiasm, quote, gap. I think that there's huge numbers of people who are incredibly enthusiastic about voting Trump out of office.
Yes, I agree.
And they're not crawling over glass to vote for Biden. They're crawling over glass to vote against Trump. And the Democrats will rev that up. And what they will try to do, which is just good political practice, is try to obscure the differences between the Bernie Sanders wing of their party and the kind of Hillary Clinton wing of their party. The question that I really have right now about all of that is not just the hidden vote for Trump, but how people are, feel about the incredible disorder in the streets. They were willing to sort of forgive, I think, initially when it was so clearly linked to the George Floyd death.
Yes.
And they said, okay, there's a legitimate gripe about unfair treatment. Maybe you disagree with that. Maybe you agree with it. But it's certainly legitimate that people are outraged about it and they're out in the street. But after a while, it morphs into a clear political movement unrelated to realistic reforms of the police. It begins not to be not only virtue signaling, but cutting not only funding for the police, but political backing for the police going out and actually doing their job. And the column that I wrote about that says, we know that policing called broken windows policing work. Broken windows policing said small crimes, if you leave them unpunished, will lead to bigger crimes. So let's go ahead.
Right.
And it worked. Yep. And what I think we've moved to now is go ahead, break our windows policing. And I think people are just outraged that they're not safe. The first duty of government is to keep people safe so they can go about their own business. They can open their corner shop. They can go shopping. If they live downtown, they can walk down the street. And you're seeing not only disorder, but you're seeing senior political leaders unwilling to speak out about that disorder.
They're not unsustainable politically. They're not addressing it. The column I wrote recently.
Yep.
The elephant in the room is in the Democratic virtual room at the convention is the violence in the streets. And yes, Trump is trying to take advantage of it. Hat tip to Jeff here. Yes, Jeff, I know he's trying to take advantage of it. But
yes,
this is the hard left attacking the administrations of liberal Democratic office holders, and nothing's being said about it on the national level from Biden to Kamala Harris. None of them.
Well,
Charles, what happens then?
What were you going to say, Jeff?
I would say, well, because they think what's happening is righteous, and so that they're not going to condemn it, like you pointed out. I mean, that's the game plan here. And John, so just to follow back, my point wasn't that Trump is dangerous to our democracy in the sense of destabilizing it, like you've talked about with the violence in the streets and leading to all these institutions being questioned in their validity. My point was that when we're coming to questioning the actual election results, that both sides are using it as a political hammer to try to smash people in the face into either voting or not believing the vote. And that's
scary. I agree with that completely, Jeff. I think that that's exactly right. And I think that the trouble will be if this election comes down to a close vote in Michigan or Minnesota or something like that, and the answer depends, as it did in the year 2000, on a close vote in Florida, there's just going to be a lot of people who won't accept it. And that has been prepared by months of this kind of these kind of politics that you're talking about, Jeff.
I agree with both of you because I'm agreeable, and I offer this after speaking to both of you, I've come up with an idea. You know, I like to go to the grocery store as a type 1 diabetic with a COVID comorbidity or whatever they call it. I still go to the grocery store to get some meats and various sausages because I like to eat and grill. And I will put on my mask and go. Now, if I could do that for meats and sausages and various chickens and a good brie, the real triple creamy brie, I could also do that for my country. I'm not on the beaches of Normandy, but I'm on the beaches. But this is the republic if we could keep it. I agree that with both of you that it's a serious issue. And so I'm going to go to the polling place, show my ID to prove that I'm not dead in the Chicago fashion, so Johnny Rocco from Key Largo can't recount me, and I will vote in person because I think that that's necessary. I think that the Republicans don't want the Democrats to do mail-in balloting for the same reason the Democrats want to, because of harvesting votes by political organizations, the Chicago way that has been done here for many years.
Well, that horse is out of the barn in the sense that it's not up to you or me. It's up to the legislature in Nevada, let's say, or Arizona or various states, some of which have never done this before on a massive basis, and they have said we're going to do it, and the courts have said that's okay, you can do that,
but they're not prepared to do it.
And then what Trump made a mistake he appointed a person who actually is a logistics expert to run the post office. Wow. And that person was not a very experienced, had no experience in politics. And he started to say, okay, here's things we can do to make the post office more efficient, none of which were going to actually happen before the election. But the Democrats then said, see, what Trump is trying to do is make sure that the mail-in voting all gets screwed up. And he's going to contribute to a mess. And so what we had this week was the people probably in the White House telling the new guy at the post office, hey, just hold off on all of this. You're giving the Democrats ammunition to run a kind of false flag operation. And so they've now said, hey, we're not going to do any of this. What the right move for the Republicans should have been is we're going to give more money. We want to give more money to the post office between now and November. But after that, we want real reforms. They should have just taken that issue off the table. It was political malpractice not to do it.
Agreed. And remember when I began this podcast in the monologue, I talked about fairy tales, and there was one, perhaps it's an apocryphal story. I hope it is true that Charles Lipson and Jeff Carlin, that the at the Constitutional Convention when our country was founded, some people got around the first Postmaster General and began to ask him, Dr. Franklin, what are we doing? What do we have, a monarchy? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. Was that a fairy tale, Charles Lipson?
I think the story is real. Benjamin Franklin exited the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The story is a particular woman, and we have the name of the woman, ask him what you said, John. And he did, in fact, reply, we have a republic, and then paused and said, if you can keep it. And, of course, George Washington and others thought that this would only last for 20 years, and we know that it's lasted since 1779, when the 1789, excuse me, when the Constitution was adopted. Now, there are stories that you hate to check into because they're so good, you want them to be true, and you don't want to find out that they might not be. And that's been my, in effect, criticism of the media on the Russia hoax. They never really looked into it because they so much wanted it to be true. And they're not reporting really what happened, not only with Kevin Kleinsmith, but the larger problems associated with the spying on the Trump campaign, because again, they didn't want to find out the answer. Let me give you an actual story that is so where you hear these stories and you want to know that they're true, but you hate to look into them. And it's a Bob Costas story about Yogi Berra. And we all love Yogi Berra stories. And we know that a lot of them really are your fairy tales, John. But this was back in the days before everybody had a cell phone and could record everything. And it was during the days of streaking where people would run naked across all sorts of things, including one person who ran across the stage at the Oscar ceremony while David Niven was on stage. And he famously ad-libbed, "Some people like to show their shortcomings." but this one was at the spring training game for the Mets, when Yogi Berra was actually managing the Mets. He had retired from being the Yankees catcher, and he was now managing the Mets. And his old teammates, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford, had heard that there was a streaking incident. And Bob Costas tells the tale, and said that it was so good that he couldn't help. He went and asked Yogi Berra a couple of weeks later whether this had actually happened. And Yogi said that the story that about Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford, his old teammates, really was true. And the story is this. Mickey and Whitey had heard about the streaking, and they asked Yogi, did it really happen? And Yogi said to him, yeah, it really did. And they said, well, tell us about it. And he said, well, Tom Seaver, the great pitcher for the Mets, was going into his windup, and all of a sudden, from behind the first base dugout, this is in spring training down in Florida, behind the first base, three people come out buck naked, and they ran straight across the infield and exited out over the third baseline. And Mickey said, wow, that's kind of amazing. And Whitey Ford said, well, Yogi, were they men or were they women? And Yogi said, well, I couldn't tell. They had bags over their heads. That's a story that's so good, you don't want to ask, lest it not be true. But our media has an obligation, if they're going to report that story, to find out something besides they were wearing bags over their heads.
Charles Lipson, that is a great, great story to tell and I end on. And I have to say that I know that Mr. Carlin has a relationship with Bob Costas, and he will be getting, next time he's on the Rokon show, he'll ask him that story.
I will.
For all of us.
It's a great story, isn't it? Bob Costas knows how to tell it. I only hope I did it justice.
You do all of us justice every time you're here and every time you take pen to paper or keyboard to whatever it is, electronic, whatever.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you, Jeff.
For Charles Lipson, the Peter B. Ritzma Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago, contributor to Real Clear Politics, Spectator USA, and many other publications. You can find him on Twitter at Charles_Lipson, and you can find him on Facebook. And please do, because you will only be helping your mind clear itself if you read him. And for Jeff Carlin, my buddy, who sold his house, his parents' house, or parents' vacation home, executive producer of the Rokon show, you did. Yeah. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, Orthodox Christian, columnist at the Tribune, member of its editorial board. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.